This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Historian Iris Ching once observed, "Celebrities are really distractions for the general public, first created, then most often destroyed, consumed for our amusement." Why then do we so many of us see fame as something to pursue, the ultimate life achievement? On the program today, we talk about fame and what happens when your 15 minutes are up. Journalist Douglas Perry is our guest. He is the co-author with Jeff Gwynn of The 16th Minute, Life in the Aftermath of Fame. The title, of course, draws on Andy Warhol's famous observation, "In the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes." The book, The 16th Minute, profiles Americans who have experienced fame. They include the former baseball player Maury Wills, the actress Irene Cara, Whitewater figure and friend of Bill and Hillary Clinton, Susan McDougal, and the man who found Howard Hughes in the desert one cold night and gave him a ride to Las Vegas. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Douglas Perry is features editor at The Oregonian, among other publications he has written for The Chicago Tribune. Perry and Gwynn's book, The 16th Minute, is published by Tarcher Penguin. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Mr. Perry, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Sure. Well, you quote the late Iris Ching in the book's introduction, and I use that quote in my introduction. Why is it that we need this distraction, this...
Well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, a lot of it has to do with just where we are in our culture right now, technology-wise, and just how much free time we have. You know, we've always been interested and fascinated by fame, but we've never before had it be the cultural high point. And that's what's fueling reality TV, you know, the egalitarian idea that, you know, we can all be on TV. You know, fame used to be reserved for people with special talents and special accomplishments, but now anyone can be famous. And I think we're going to see more aggressive kind of negative behavior towards professional athletes and actors because it's their celebrity that makes them special now, not their accomplishments. So people are starting to say to themselves, you know, why him? Why not me?
Yeah. Well, look at Paris Hilton, for example.
Well, exactly. She's a perfect case study. And I know a lot of people who are kind of fascinated by her but embarrassed to admit it. And she kind of makes people mad. You know, why her? You know, it's plain old-fashioned envy.
Yeah. You also say in the introduction that our need for the fall, that consumption that Iris Ching talked about, has become insatiable.
It absolutely has. We just can't get enough of it. And, we now have our 300 channels and we have the internet. And so these people are inescapable. They are everywhere. And, there's just something about, you know, being on that little box in our living rooms. Well, it used to be a little box. Now it's, you know, a large moving painting. That just makes you important in people's eyes. You know, people love the celebrity, and in the process, they kind of hate themselves for not being at that level, which is why you see this constant, you know, build them up and tear them down cycle. You see it. I used to live in Los Angeles, and, you know, at various times at the mall or whatever, I'd come upon, you know, guys like Kirk Cameron or Judge Reinhold, you know, actors whose time had passed, and they were pretty anonymous, but once someone recognized them, boom, it was like they were the president. People would just start approaching and just be so pleased to see them. You see it in the fact that O.J. Simpson is warmly greeted wherever he goes, even by people who think he's guilty of murder. You know, that's the power of celebrity. And everyone wants that. Everyone wants that validation.
Yeah. And even if their moment of fame is gone, we can have a brush with fame if we come across them.
Right. I mean, I'm a journalist, even, you know, when my fellow journalists will meet celebrities or see a celebrity, you know, there's this buzz about it. They have to tell people, you know, I saw so-and-so, I met so-and-so. we're supposed to be a pretty cynical bunch, but it's just throughout the culture now. We're all infected by it. It means something to have seen someone who not necessarily has accomplished anything, but who has simply been on TV, has his name or her name is out there in the ether. It's really interesting that fact, and people just invest so much into it. Kind of, you know, it's the ideal life.
But if we know that fame is fleeting, and fame can be gone in an instant, and the downfall can be so painful, so horrible, why do you suppose we're so eager to achieve it?
Well, again, because it does, offer up the possibility of the perfect life, and we see that in, all these cable shows that focus in on celebrities. Fame and wealth infantilize people. They give us that opportunity to be, whatever we want. Losing fame often gives people maturity. You know, we used to expect maturity to come, with normal life experience, but that's old school thinking. You know, I know plenty of middle-aged people who are stuck at age 16. You know, our culture encourages childishness, childish wants and needs and behavior. Now, for some celebrities, losing that fame kind of boots them out of that, that state, that kind of blank state, blandness, that corporatized PR nothingness that we've all become so accustomed to from our stars. As a journalist, that's very refreshing. It's one of the reasons we wanted to do this book. You know, I've talked to many celebrities, during my career, and it's usually a waste of time. You know, like politicians, they've got their talking points, and it's nearly impossible to knock them off their message, off of their public persona. And that's what was so exciting to journalists about Tom Cruise's recent interviews. You know, whether you agreed with him or not, it was nice to see a glimpse of a real, live human being who had real opinions and emotions.
What did put you on track to write this book?
Jeff and I were just got to talking. Now, we do come in contact with a lot of celebrities in our work, and in a culture defined by celebrity, we wanted to explore what it was like to achieve that ultimate validation and then lose it. And so we set upon about a half dozen men and women who had been very famous for varying periods of time and for varying reasons, and who had lost that fame. And how did that affect them? How does it affect your psyche when the, ultimate achievement is gone? And that's certainly one thing we found out in our research for this book, is that everybody is changed by celebrity. Even if your moment in the spotlight was exceptionally brief, it rearranges your head. This is America, so it's rare that someone doesn't think they deserve the attention, but you can't unring that bell. So they spend the rest of their lives, consciously or not, trying to get back that celebrity or rationalizing their loss of fame. So it's interesting. It's actually, it used to be pretty brutal. Now it's getting easier for former celebrities because reality TV is giving them a chance to get back into the spotlight.
That's interesting. They still crave the spotlight?
Oh, very much so. Irene Cara was, she's in the book, and she was just on Baby Hit Me One More Time, which was a reasonable hit that brings back a bunch of pop stars from Vanilla Ice to Howard Jones to Irene to sing their old hits and sing some new songs and have a competition. And in all the interviews I did with her, Irene just, you know, had such bitterness towards the music industry and Hollywood in general, because she was treated very shabbily. And so it's interesting to see her, you know, come back and embrace this. She just couldn't resist it.
Yeah. Well, as you point out in that profile, she was Queen of the Grammys in 1984. Flashdance, what a feeling. She's 22 years of age, and not long after this point, it all comes crashing down because she gets in a fight with a record company and this creepy executive. While the record was a huge hit, she was in debt to this guy in the company. What happened?
Right, yeah. People forget what a huge star she was. After starring in Fame, the movie, and then putting out an album and doing the soundtrack for Flashdance, she was as big as it gets. She was huge. And then it did. It all crashed down very swiftly. The music industry is a tough business, and it is typical, probably more typical then than now, but typical for new artists to get locked into contracts that are not fair to them. And she saw that her record label and her manager not only were not living up to a contract that wasn't fair to begin with, but still weren't paying her due, what she should have gotten in that contract. And she made the mistake of thinking it was her right to stand up and say, no, I deserve to get paid, you know. And, she had the biggest hit in the country in 1983 and got nothing for it. She got like $20 in royalties. And so she went to court. And unfortunately, the man that she took to court was very powerful. And she ended up in court for years. And, you know, while that was going on, she couldn't get another job. She essentially got blackballed. That's certainly her take on it, and I tend to believe her. When you're, music fans are fickle, and the whole business is fickle. So if you go 3, 4, 5, 6 years out of the spotlight, you're gone.
Yeah. The profile is called Irene Cara, the Prodigy. Her mother assured her from an early age, this is where the prodigy comes in. She was a very talented young child, very talented child. But then her mother, pushed and pushed, and her mother told her, you'll be a star. What was her childhood like?
It's certainly not like yours and mine. From a very young age, that was her job, was to be a star. And, when you're told you're going to be a star from the age of 4 or 5, you tend to believe it. And she certainly believed it. And so going on auditions and going to voice lessons, and that was her life from a very young age. And she was successful. So school took a back seat. Having normal childhood friends took a back seat. Everything took a back seat to performing. And she was quite successful, on TV and in the movies, as a teenager. And then the big breakthrough with Fame, what made her a movie star. And so when it all came crashing down just a few years later, she was completely adrift. She had nothing else that she knew in life. What do you do when that is all you know, literally all you know? You have no education. You've never held any other kind of job than a show business job or performing job. She's a very strong woman. She's very determined, and she had some very tough times. She didn't have to keep fighting the good fight in court, but she just determined to stick it out. She eventually won, though not much money came with that. And, she had some really tough years financially. And she's trying to get things going again. I don't know if she can, but she's trying real hard.
Yeah. She's got a website. You can check her out on the web and find out about her latest projects, including a band called Hot Caramel, which I understand it looks like it's still a going concern.
It is. She's been working on an album for a number of years now. It's taken a long time because she's very nervous about record labels, and she just wants to do it herself. And the technology allows that now, so she's slowly doing it herself as finances allow. And I'm not sure if she's going to try to look for a record label when it's done, or if she's going to just put it out on her own. I don't know. So we'll see.
Yeah. One of the heartbreaking aspects, I guess I would say, of this story and of Fame is this question that comes to you in that moment of Fame or at some point along the continuum. Are people drawn to you for who you are or because you're famous?
Right. That's something that everyone who gets any kind of public attention has to deal with. And there's a flip side to that. To me, the most heartbreaking story that we have to tell in this book is that of Melvin Dumar. People may remember the movie Melvin and Howard. He was a gas station attendant in Utah who was driving through the Nevada desert in 1967, and he claims he picked up Howard Hughes on the side of the road and drove him into town. And a few years later, after Hughes died, a will appeared that named Melvin as the main beneficiary. And Melvin is a guy who, he's not an educated man and always a hard worker. And, he believed from watching TV and going to the movies that being famous would solve all his problems. And so when he became famous, he was shocked when his problems only escalated. It was, the whole incident destroyed him in a very significant way, and it's a sad story to see him struggle with trying to come to terms with the fact that what he always believed would come of his quest for fame, his desire to be a singer, wasn't what he thought.
Yeah. His story runs throughout the book. You want to bring us up to date on where he is now?
Melvin still lives in Utah. He went through, he had cancer a couple years ago, and it was really touch and go there for a while, but he's now in remission. He is still working away. He now delivers meats. To rural areas in Utah, in Nevada. It's his own little operation. He just buys it wholesale and packs it in a freezer that he sticks in the back of his truck, and he just drives out to these little tiny towns that are miles from grocery stores. That's how he makes his living. He's bitter in that he doesn't understand what happened to him. It's fascinating. A retired FBI agent a few years back got interested in Melvin's case and did a lot of research and came to the conclusion that Melvin was telling the truth, that he did indeed pick up Howard Hughes in the desert. There's a fair amount of evidence that supports that. It's really a shame that he just had really bad timing. This was before DNA was available. Nowadays, you'd be able to just run some DNA on that will that popped up and see whether or not any of Howard Hughes' DNA is on there. But in a normal, run-of-the-mill operations, after the trial was over, the original will was destroyed.
Mm-hmm. One element of fame in this story is how fear can come with it.
That's true. Again, it's for so many people, particularly those who don't have strong support systems in family and business, fame is not what they expected. There's a lot more pressure than they ever anticipated, a lot more tension and feeling that they have to live up to expectations. You certainly see that in Jerry Cooney's case, and you see it in Maury Wills. In a sense, you see it in Susan McDougall, who made her kind of personal decision about what she thought was right, and she wasn't going to back down from that. It can be very dangerous when you get yourself out in the public eye, because you no longer own your own story, and people, for reasons good and ill, can define you how they so choose.
Well, these people in the book have come through. They've come through their own way, but you call them survivors, and rightfully so.
Absolutely. It's every single one of them. They are survivors, and they've all kind of made their own peace with their place in history and in fame. As I was just saying, I think the hardest part, and this is why you see Hollywood now is so cocooned in PR. That wasn't the case 30 years ago, but it is the case now, because again, there is so many opportunities and so many people with agendas to redefine people. Certainly, when Susan McDougall first came into the public eye, I, like so many people, tended to think she was guilty of something. After all, she had been convicted, that she had done terrible things, that she perhaps had an affair with Bill Clinton. It's only after really looking into it that I started to realize, geez, this is not, the reality isn't what we were told through the mainstream media and many other sources. And the history of Whitewater is still being written, and we probably won't see the definitive history on that for a number of years yet. So I think it takes a lot of courage in the face of, seeing so many falsehoods about yourself out there to stick to your guns and stick to your principles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she did. And being in prison really was a turning point for her in a very positive way. And it's impressive. I must admit, I was surprised by how much I was impressed by Susan McDougall. She's a strong-willed woman. She has a lot of courage. And she took the lumps for reasons that a lot of people would have said, you know what, I'll tell you what you want.
Yeah. She's got to hope that it'll come out, what happened.
She certainly does. She certainly does hope that that it will. But we're at a stage now where there is no such thing as nonpartisan truth. So no matter what is written right now, if it's positive towards her, it will be attacked by those who have reason to take issue with you with it. So it's probably going to be 30, 40, 50 years from now before you can see, how history is going to remember Susan McDougall and Whitewater.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Douglas Perry. He is co-author with Jeff Gwynn of The 16th Minute, Life in the Aftermath of Fame. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion with questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. I look forward to hearing from you this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455, WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, speaking of politics, let's talk about Jim Wright.
Yes.
survivor of a great public fall, and a survivor of cancer.
Yes, Jim Wright is a fascinating man. There's no doubt that he did things that he shouldn't have done. You know, in the grand scheme of things, they weren't major, but they were wrong. But what's interesting is it's all a matter of timing, and his case goes to show how much things have changed in the last 15 years. The main thing with Jim Wright is he put out a book of speeches and sold them in a way that that kind of bypassed laws that govern how congressmen are allowed to accept outside payments. Wasn't a significant amount of money, but it was dancing around the corners of what congressmen were allowed to do. 15 years ago, it was kind of expected that when you get caught up in something like that, that you would resign. Nowadays, any congressman or member of an administration who found himself in such a situation would not resign, but would respond with a full-throated attack on their critics. That's one of the factors behind the whole idea that the mainstream media is liberal. It's because right now we have a conservative government, and so anytime any kind of facts come out that doesn't make the administration look good, that's a way to spin it. You didn't hear that when Clinton was in power. There was different criticisms of the media, so that's just the way it goes nowadays. So he felt very bitter, in part because it was Newt Gingrich who attacked him and brought him down, and Gingrich, of course, has had his own ethical troubles that were as bad or worse than anything Wright faced. But sort of like Susan McDougall with going to prison, the clarifying moment for Jim Wright was a few years after leaving office, he was diagnosed with cancer. It's been a very difficult time for him. He's lost much of his tongue and much of his jaw. He's had to relearn how to speak. And for Jim Wright, that's a huge thing to have trouble speaking. He's made his career out of speaking. He loves speaking, loves talking to people. Still in Fort Worth, Texas, where he lives. He can be seen around town, loves to meet people and shake hands. So it was really, it helped him put things in perspective. It helped him understand that, he wasn't the most important person in the world, that there were other things in life that were important. And so he's starting to take advantage of those things now, better late than never.
Yeah. Something that has been really important for him, the support of friends and family, people who stood by him.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what can happen to celebrities when something goes wrong and there's a scandal or, they lose their fame. It's the old saying, you only in adversity do you find out who your friends are. It's nice because you can be left completely alone like Maury Wills was, who just he didn't make any friends when he was a pro ball player. And once that was gone, he felt this void and just spiraled into drug use out of just kind of loneliness and not knowing what to do with himself. Wright had a support system, on the other hand. He had his wife and he had close friends, and he had a community in Fort Worth that, even though the community at large was getting more conservative and more Republican, there was still a base of support and people, Republican and Democrat, in the area who still respected him and treated him with respect.
Yeah, something that he told you and your co-author Jeff Gwynn in the 16th minute that you write about is how he pulled himself together, and he said, you know, I've got to let go. I've got to get let go of this bitterness, because the bitterness is not going to hurt my enemies. It will only hurt me. It'll kill me. And
right.
I think that that was, you know, there are lessons in this book, whether you're famous or not, you know?
Absolutely. You know, Jim Wright was very, very candid in the book about the fact that for years he was very selfish, and while he certainly wanted to help people while he was a congressman, he also did it in large part because he liked the feeling of power. He liked being famous and having people recognize him and come up to him. And when you lose that, we found throughout this book that either you become really bitter about it, or you realize how empty that need is in many ways. You know, it's we all have the same, you know, desires and needs to be accepted and to be loved. And it becomes a bit twisted when you become famous. Again, it's like becoming a child again. You know, it would be very difficult to deal with if you were 3 years old and then the next day you were suddenly 40 years old and people are treating you differently and you have to get around in life and figure things out. You wouldn't be able to do it. That's how it is for a lot of celebrities, particularly if they become famous at a young age. They don't remember anything else. They don't know how to use a checkbook. They don't know how to pay bills. They don't know how to do all sorts of things that were taken care of for them while they were the star. And so what happens when you lose all that? You know, it's very disorienting. And you either spiral into a worse situation or it really forces you to mature and to have some perspective and be thoughtful. And Jim Wright was old enough and wise enough that he realized that being angry and being bitter wasn't going to do him any good, and it wasn't going to hurt his enemies any. So he learned to let go. And I'm sure he took satisfaction in Newt Gingrich's fall.
Yeah.
But, he doesn't really admit to it. And he's just happy to be alive, and he's happy to be enjoying his life. And if anything, his regret is not about his loss of power, but about the years that he didn't appreciate his family life and didn't spend much time with his wife and his children.
Mm.
And he's trying to get that back.
Yeah. It was all about politics there for a while. And anytime they entertained, they did anything, it was all about who's on the guest list and why is it important that they're here and so on and so forth. And that also is part of Maury Will's story. It was all about baseball. He's so hooked on the game that when his wife was in labor and the baby and the mother are in trouble, he doesn't leave the game. He's bent on winning.
Right. Yeah, that's an amazing story. When his wife, he was in Los Angeles playing ball, his wife was in Seattle, and she went into labor. And Maury got a call. The doctor said, there's trouble with the delivery. The child might make it. Your wife might not make it. You must come back right now. And Maury Will said, you're the doctor. You take care of it. I have a ball game to play. And he did not go back. And his wife almost died. And Maury tells that story today not with any shame at all. He doesn't tell it as a way to say, you know, look, I was a jerk then, but boy, I learned and I'm better now. He tells it as an ultimate example of how dedicated he was to baseball, and he's proud of that dedication. You know, Maury Wills was not a supreme athletic talent. He had to work very hard, and he's very proud of that. So there's much to admire in that kind of single-mindedness and determination. There are downsides, as this story points out. And another downside is that, you know, particularly when it comes to something like athletics, where you halfway through your life that's going to be over. Then what? That was extremely difficult for Maury Wills. He didn't know how to do anything else. That's all that mattered to him was baseball. And he tried to be a coach and a manager, but as is often the case with the superstars of the game, they don't understand how to motivate other players because that motivation came very naturally to them. Mm-hmm. And so it's difficult for them to understand other players and how they go about their jobs and their lives. So that didn't work out for him. Spiraled into drug abuse, and it took him a long time to get out of it. And what's interesting is just what an obsessive personality he is. He is now sober, and he is as obsessive about his sobriety as he was about playing baseball, and that's how he does it.
Yeah. I wonder if he could be a good manager today, although he says, the game is different, and these young kids today, they don't want to listen to me. I'm an old geezer.
Yeah, probably not, because the game has changed so dramatically. There's so much money in the game now that it's not about teaching fundamentals or strategy so much, which are things he could do. It's much more about figuring out how to keep all the egos aligned properly to form a cohesive team. And Maury Wills does not have the personality to be able to deal with that.
He says he didn't want to be famous. He didn't want to be known as a great base stealer. He wanted to be a great base stealer. At the same time, he'd love to be in the Hall of Fame.
Sure. Well, of course. Maury Wills, he's 70 years old, and his generation thinks differently about fame and celebrity than younger generations, certainly than most of the people who are, say, on reality TV shows today. For guys like Maury Wills, the accomplishment was the thing. And fame and celebrity would come out of great accomplishments. I believe him when he says that. Because he wanted to be the best at something, and he achieved that. And it's nice to get recognition for that, and he wants recognition for that, but it didn't necessarily need to be, a big celebrity for that to be meaningful to him. Whereas nowadays, accomplishment is increasingly becoming a secondary consideration. Fame in and of itself is what's important. And you see that in the fact that, you look at Kelly Clarkson, who I also write about in the book, the first American Idol winner, just how big a star she is, and the fact that people look at her in the same way, not everybody, but certainly younger people, the same way that they look at, a Bob Dylan, who has this incredible track record and who has a real meaning in our culture. Younger people don't distinguish as much between ephemeral pop and more meaningful art because it's only the celebrity, the fame, that has resonance. And for people like Maury Wills and Jim Wright, they don't understand that. They don't understand that. And in that degree, Melvin Dumar was actually ahead of his time. He didn't see anything for fame other than what it was, recognition, public attention. Accomplishment didn't really speak to him in the same way that simply being on TV did. It's interesting now to look at some older people who were famous and how they look at younger stars today. Mm-hmm. Things have changed so dramatically.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I'd like you to return, if you'd be a good fellow, to the Susan McDougall case. She's one of my favorite characters in the American ruling class, albeit the bottom tier. And it's women like her that keep men like me going on, to be real honest with you. Her heroism is absolutely extraordinary. What is the status of her case at the moment? Who's doing her biography? And where do you think she was placed, in your opinion, on Bill Clinton's last-minute pardon list? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. A lot of questions. We've got about 3 minutes left in this portion of the show. Go ahead.
Yes, Susan is a remarkable person. She's written a memoir which is out there, and we look at it from a more objective at her life, a more objective point of view in our book. She was very surprised to be pardoned by Bill Clinton. She hadn't spoken to him for 10 years, except for very briefly. She was never a close friend of Bill Clinton's. She, it was her ex-husband who had the long relationship with Clinton. And, one thing that was a surprise to me was the fact that, she didn't do it for Clinton. She didn't do it to save herself embarrassment of revelations. She did it because she recognized that she was being asked to lie to make up, a story that would fit someone else's narrative about Bill Clinton and Whitewater to get off the hook, and she wouldn't do it. It's a familiar prosecutor's strategy, and nothing wrong with it to leverage the threat of prosecution to get someone to talk. But what they were trying to do was get her to say things that weren't true. They had certain facts or pseudo facts that they wanted confirmed, and they believed she could confirm them, or that she would, truthfully or not. I can't get inside of the heads of Kenneth Starr or his other prosecutors. But Susan McDougall said right from the outset to the IOC, I wish I could tell you something that the Clintons did that was illegal. I would tell you if I knew anything. I don't know anything. And when they kept pushing her to say things, even after she made clear that she didn't know anything, that's when she decided to dig in her feet and say, I'm just not going to testify, to anything that I don't know to be true. And she got stuck in a catch-22 because her ex-husband was willing to make up stories for the IOC. So she really had no choice. She could either lie or she could go to prison. And she decided to go to prison. And there are few people out there that courageous.
Hmm. We're out of time. Douglas Perry, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Journalist Douglas Perry has been our guest this afternoon. He's features editor at The Oregonian. And together with Jeff Gwynn, he's the author of The 16th Minute, Life in the Aftermath of Fame. The 16th Minute is published by Tarcher Penguin.